There are signs more independents will vote in next month's primary, potentially many more. So how do candidates try to win their votes?
It's very comfortable to dig down and say, what do independents want that will bring a large block of them because they're so diverse? And so whatever candidate can figure out how to make that happen, they're going to own Arizona in the years to come.
I'm Mark Brody, today on the show, trying to win the elusive independent vote. Also, voters may not be able to cast ballots for two at-large community college seats, why we live in the part of the valley we do, and Phoenix is flush with storytellers.
Story is as natural as day and night, and it is as relevant to every part of our life as day and night.
Plus, why Germans love the Old West and remembering a beloved valley icon. That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. If you like it hot, you're going to love today. Look for partly cloudy skies to stick around for the rest of the afternoon. Slight chance we could see some afternoon showers and thunderstorms before the day is out. High today reaching near 110. It'll be partly cloudy tonight with blowing dust and scattered thunderstorms possible. Overnight lows tonight reaching around 90. It's 105 degrees right now at KJZZ. Quick check of valley traffic. There's a disabled vehicle on the I-10 westbound at US 60 and an accident blocking the shoulder I-10 westbound at Warner. The Phoenix Police Department is changing how it'll patrol neighborhoods this fall. As KJZZ's Steve Shadley reports, Police Chief Daniel Garcia has approved new precinct boundaries to cope with the shortage of officers.
The size of the precincts is changing, and some officers will start working in different neighborhoods. Plus, there will be a new patrol district in downtown Phoenix. Spokesman Steve Martos compares the new precinct map to a pie.
Some of those pieces of pie may be larger than others because of calls for service or call volume or types of calls. So it is the same number of officers that we have out there that we have right now. It is just a matter of how we're going to divvy them up to address crime issues throughout the city.
Marto says Phoenix has almost 500 fewer officers than it did 5 years ago because many have left the force and their jobs weren't filled because of the city's budget crisis. He says the new precincts allow the department to spread officers across the city more evenly. The new boundaries go into effect in October. Steve Shadley, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The Arizona Court of Appeals ruled this week that a 2010 law creating two new at-large seats on the Maricopa Community College District Governing Board is unconstitutional. The judges said the measure violates the state constitution's ban on special laws since it only affected Maricopa County. Attorney Joe Canefield, now a partner with Ballard Spahr, worked for the governor when she signed the bill into law.
The courts have fashioned a test that allows for some flexibility, and this is a good example where legislation based upon population can survive constitutional scrutiny. But if it's written in a way where the reality is that there will only ever be one member of the class, then it's going to be struck down.
So in this case, if the law had been written to set the population threshold for community college districts that need to have at-large seats, might it have passed constitutional muster?
If it had set the threshold lower? Yeah, I think so. I mean, the problem here was that it set the threshold at 3 million. There's only one county in the state that has that, meets that requirement. The closest two counties are Pinal and Pima County, and they're, according to the ASU professor who was the expert witness on behalf of the challengers in this case, says it's going to be close to 100 years before any other county grows to that level. And that, under the test that's been fashioned by the courts over the years when interpreting legislation in the face of a special legislation challenge, they ask the question, well, the class has to be elastic, meaning that persons, places, or things have to be able to move within and with outside the class. If that's not possible, there's not a reasonable probability, and that's the language that the court uses, of that happening, then it's going to be considered special legislation. And that's exactly what the court held in this case.
So you were with the governor's office when this bill went through the legislature and when the governor signed it. Was there a concern that the special legislation provision might be violated by the threshold of 3 million people?
Well, thinking back to 2010 when this law was passed, as I recall, the concerns expressed weren't necessarily related to whether the law was special legislation. The concerns that were raised had to do with the Voting Rights Act, because at the time, Arizona was still a covered jurisdiction under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, and all its voting laws had to be pre-cleared by the Department of Justice. The United States Supreme Court ends up striking down the formula for coverage, so the coverage, the Section 5 goes away. Arizona's no longer a covered jurisdiction under the Voting Rights Act. The Attorney General then subsequently issues an opinion saying that this law can go into effect. So now here we are in 2014 with a law passed in 2010 that was really ineffective for several years because of the failure of the Department of Justice to pre-clear it. And we're now faced with a new Court of Appeals opinion on a different subject, striking it down.
Do you think that ultimately when the Supreme Court rules on this, assuming that it does, that it will be sort of precedent setting as far as what the legislature needs to do, as far as setting the threshold for writing legislation that maybe only affects a couple of different entities?
Very possible. This is the kind of case where, you've got a constitutional provision that's been on the books in statehood. You've got cases interpreting it over the decades. You've got a test that the Supreme Court applies, a three-part test that includes this elasticity component, which is usually where these cases are litigated. And then you've got inconsistent application of the test, so that it's ripe for consideration by the court. Not that the Supreme Court will change the outcome. I mean, it's very possible that the Supreme Court would accept review, which is discretionary, and affirm the Court of Appeals opinion. But it may do so in a way where it provides more clarity and more guidance to the legislature in terms of how the test should be applied in the future.
Attorney Joe Canefield. The state attorney general's office says it plans to appeal this week's ruling to the Arizona Supreme Court and ask the justices to issue their ruling in time to either include the seats on the ballot or not, depending on the decision. That deadline is in early September. KJZZ, by the way, is licensed to the Maricopa Community College District. West Valley Hospital in Goodyear opened the doors to its Level 1 Trauma Center this week. It's the westernmost such center in the state. Daniel Didier, the hospital's trauma operations director, says the hospital brought in more than 50 surgical specialists and conducted more than 70 mock drills with simulated patients to get ready. Didier says this is a big deal for his hospital.
Having that ability to go public and receive the state designation as a Level 1 trauma center to the west part of the Phoenix metro area has been truly a feather in our cap, and we're very proud of that because of all the hard work that has gone into this, and we look forward to continuing that service in the future as we continue to build and grow with our communities here in the West Valley.
I know the Level 1 trauma center has only been open for a few days now, but what kind of activity have you seen in there, if any, already?
We've started to see some activity. So, naturally our area that we are covering is not just the western portion of the Phoenix metro area, but we're covering also the western part of the state all the way to the state border, from Yuma all the way up to Bullhead and Kingman. So it's a vast area which is very well known, too, from a data perspective, from a trauma system point, that there's a lot of high acuity accidents and injuries that take place within this huge catchment area. So we've had an active week starting up with our go-live date on Monday, and we look for those numbers to start to increase as more people get more comfortable with us being open here and providing the service to the community as a whole.
I hate to ask this question. It might sound kind of crass because you're kind of banking on there being serious accidents or other problems people are having. But is there sort of a sweet spot for the number of patients you might see on a given day or in a given week that you're shooting for?
I guess that overall, you can never anticipate when any type of an injury or an accident is going to take place. Knowing the data that is supported by the state of Arizona and looking at the injuries that take place out in this region, there is definitely an identified need. Thus is why it was an initiative for us to become part of the trauma system to deliver this service to this region. When you talk about injuries overall and how that pertains to trauma, we deal with what's called the golden hour. And that golden hour starts from the time an incident takes place. And there's a higher survivability rate with those patients that are treated within that golden hour. So with having this type of a resource to cover this western region and the high acuity and the high amount of injuries that take place out here, this will actually reduce the transport time of those patients that are under the clock, and we'll be able to get that right patient to the right place in the right amount of time for better outcomes for those all those communities, including this entire western region of Arizona.
Daniel Didier is Trauma Operations Director for West Valley Hospital. How much of an impact it'll have on patients living in rural western Arizona is somewhat of a question, according to Debbie Johnston. She's Vice President of Policy Development for the Arizona Hospital and Healthcare Association and says West Valley patients will now have much closer access to the highest level of trauma care. But she says it's not clear if that'll be the case for those living between Goodyear and California.
For example, in La Paz County, patients that need level one trauma services are typically flown into Las Vegas or into Phoenix, often to St. Joe's. Now, what's going to happen is it's possible that some of those patients will now go into the West Valley. We're just going to have to see whether or not the data shows there's a commensurate improvement in outcomes.
Johnston says level one trauma centers need to have a certain volume in order to get that designation, which makes it tough for rural hospitals to get it. She says there's not a right number for these kinds of facilities in the state. Instead, Johnston says it's helpful to look at some numbers, like the death rate in Arizona versus other states and response times. She says trauma care in the valley is excellent, but that as the system matures, there are some areas where there's some room for improvement.
This includes, you know, further integration of the rural providers, so, you know, having more level fours and level three trauma centers in rural areas, also integrating rehabilitation and other post-acute care services into the system to ensure patients get follow-up care, such as occupational therapy and physical therapy, and then we need to continue to focus on the prevention efforts.
Johnston says she doesn't expect any new Level 1 trauma centers to open in Arizona in the foreseeable future. Still to come, why do we live in the part of the valley in which we live, and what does that mean?
Everybody really controls the politics, economics, the culture of the city, and its aesthetics all through the small individual choices that they make every day.
A look at the individualocracy is ahead. It's the show. Not too many problems right now on Valley Freeways, just a disabled vehicle on I-10 westbound at the 60. There's also an accident on I-10 westbound at Warner that's blocking the shoulder. Well, what you see outside right now, pretty much what you're going to get for the rest of the afternoon, partly cloudy and hot. There is a slight chance we could see some showers and thunderstorms later this afternoon. Look for a high today of 110. Partly cloudy with a chance of rain both tomorrow and Sunday. Highs both days right around 108. It's 106 degrees at KJZZ at 216.
KJZZ is supported by SRP, managing the valley's water long before it reaches our cities, so there will be enough water today and for generations. Learn more at togetherweconserve.com. SRP, delivering water and power.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody.
Early voting for Arizona's primary election starts next Thursday, and the highest-profile, most congested battle is among the Republican gubernatorial candidates. The six in the race are Ken Bennett, Doug Ducey, Christine Jones, Frank Riggs, Scott Smith, and Andrew Thomas. Consultant Barrett Marson says he's keeping a close eye on independents who decide to request a GOP ballot.
This race could hinge, in fact, on how many independents come out. Clearly, Christine Jones and Doug Ducey are spending money, running TV ads. They're surrogates or independent expenditure groups, whatever you want to call them. They are also spending money. And you don't hear a lot from Scott Smith or Ken Bennett. We've heard a lot lately about Andy Thomas and Frank Riggs. I would say that not much of that has been positive.
Illegal immigration is really, really back in the forefront. How big an issue do you think that is for primary voters?
In the past, illegal immigration has been number one. Then we saw it subside a little over a couple of years. Now with the Obama administration moving children from Texas to Arizona, you know, immigration is right at the forefront at one of the most important times in Arizona election calendar. It's all of a sudden become such a big deal for Republican voters who are upset both at the handling of these immigrant children and the open borders that a lot of us still see. So, you know, immigration is going to be number one, probably among the electorate.
We have Ducey, who's been elected statewide. We also have Ken Bennett, who's been elected statewide. Do you think that matters? Do you think they have the name recognition more so than Christine Jones, more so than Scott Smith?
No. The, you know, a lot of legislators or statewide elected officials like to think that because they've been elected to an office that immediately everyone knows them. That is not the case for some of these low-rent offices, if you will. The treasurer's office is not high-profile. Ken Bennett has used the office and has done some things that has been helpful to raise his profile, but he's hampered by the fact that he doesn't have anything more than about $800,000 to run his entire race.
Consultant Barrett Marson of Marson Media.
More than twice as many independent voters in Maricopa County have requested an early ballot for next month's primary than voted in the 2012 primary. Maricopa County Recorder Helen Purcell says independents now have a better chance of knowing they can vote.
I don't think people talked about it before, except there are a lot of them out there. Well, what can they do? So I think now we're saying this is what you can do. You can vote, and this is the way you can let us know how you want to vote.
There are more Arizona voters registered as other than either Republicans or Democrats in Arizona, and independents are able to vote in primaries, but by and large, they haven't. Former State Senator Rich Crandall says voters become independents for lots of reasons, so it can be tough for candidates to target them. He says those efforts also depend on the kind of race a candidate's in.
If it's a two-person race in an all-Republican or a heavy Republican district, say Apache Junction, Gilbert, Mesa, the independent voters don't weigh in as much, especially if it's just a two-person race. Now, if you're in North Phoenix and you've got a five- or a six-person race where, you know, a few hundred votes or a 1,000 votes can tip the scale, independent voters are much, much more important.
Are there enough independents requesting ballots to really make a difference, do you think, in any particular race?
You know, that's a great question. I actually, knowing that I was going to be speaking today, I told and asked that exact question to a few people. And folks kind of point back to that Ben Quayle congressional run here, what, 4 years ago, where you had 7-8 candidates. And I don't know the exact number, but I think Ben Quayle ended up winning that primary with like 17,000 votes or something.
I think there were 10 candidates in that race, and the win, and Mr. Quayle did win, but and as you point out, it was the vote was obviously very well split.
It was so split to where if there were a candidate who carried an independent message in that race, that could have had a significant impact on that that election. So if you look at some races like that, are there ones out there that that make a difference? There are a few races. I'll tell you the one to watch the closest is the governor's race. When you've got six Republicans and you've got four that are going for that that side of it, that's a big deal.
When you talk about an independent message, what does that look like?
I think what one when you look at an independent, they are not an ideologue one way or the other. Some may have left the Republican Party, some may have left the Democratic Party. Some don't believe in the party system. They don't swing way far right or way liberal, but you just kind of say, hey, I can work to make your life better. And that's kind of your message in the primary.
Can you envision a time in Arizona in which more independents will be requesting ballots and maybe play a more proportional role in primaries?
It would be naive to say no. Somewhere down the road, someone's going to figure out what it is that triggers independents. It's very complicated to dig down and say, what do independents want that will bring a large block of them because they're so diverse? And so whenever candidate can figure out how to make that happen, they're going to own Arizona in the years to come.
Rich Crandall is a former GOP state senator.
How do you get more people to vote in Arizona, especially those who are younger and not tied to one of the two traditional political parties? One group says technology is a pretty good way to start. And Paul Johnson, chairman of Open Nonpartisan Elections, says the new Arizona nonpartisan movement phone app can have an impact.
What we're hoping that the phone app will do is make it very easy for independents and independent-minded Republicans and Democrats to be able to tie into the system. There's a way in which somebody can request an early ballot through the phone app. There's a survey of questions that it asks people to get their opinions on issues, and also a survey of candidates, so it can begin to get candidates' positions on how they feel about different issues.
Paul, how important do you think technology is when it comes to this in a more general sense? Because I'm even wondering, at some point, could people vote via an app?
You can get pretty close to voting by this app right now. Literally, you can go on and register to vote through this app. You can request an early ballot very easily through this app. We've already gotten about 2,500 people that are independent voters that have been signed up through the app that have requested early ballots.
That's Paul Johnson of Open Nonpartisan Elections. The app is free, and you can use it on your iPhone or Android.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ.
This is the best burrito I've ever eaten. Yum, yum, yum.
You may have heard about the search for the best burrito in the country, which is being led by statistician Nate Silver's blog 538. That search got us thinking about the best burrito in the Valley. So we're on the hunt, leaving no burrito unfolded or unbitten. But we need your help. Tell us your favorite burrito in town by emailing us at theshow@kjzz.org. It just might end up with the coveted title, official winner of the KJZZ Best Burrito Bonanza 2014.
This is the best burrito I've ever eaten. Yum, yum, yum.
KJZZ is supported by Friends of Animal Care and Control, providing spay and neuter vouchers to help reduce pet overpopulation. Help eliminate euthanasia at Valley shelters by donating to this program at SaveShelterPets.org.
Teenagers have never really enjoyed the best of reputations, surly, rebellious, and ready to experiment with alcohol, drugs, and cigarettes. That's the traditional image, but in the UK, new official figures suggest it may be entirely wrong. Teens are actually doing less of these things than their parents did, and far less than they did even 10 years ago. The BBC's Janet Berry explains.
The news that most British teenagers are actually rather clean, living, conservative young people might come as a surprise to anyone who's actually parented one. But figures from the government's Health and Social Care Information Centre suggest that's exactly what's happening. Just one in five of the 11 to 15-year-olds surveyed said they'd ever tried cigarettes, for example. That's half the number of those questioned just a decade ago, and the lowest ever since the survey started in 1982. One in six said they tried illegal drugs, compared to almost one in three 10 years ago. And fewer than one in ten had drunk alcohol in the last week, compared to one in four in 2003. On the streets of London, 15-year-old Kimberly and her 41-year-old mum Kirsty said it's a trend they've really noticed.
I mean, when I was my daughter's age, I was out on a Friday and Saturday night getting drunk, whereas she isn't.
Why do you think it's different for this generation, your daughter's generation?
Well, I just believe it's because if they ask for a drink, we'll let them have a drink at the house. They don't feel as if they've got to go behind our backs to do it.
My mum and dad are just dead laid back, don't really mind. And that's why I don't go causing trouble, because I know they probably wouldn't react to what I did anyway.
This is a trend that's been gathering momentum for over a decade, and not just in the UK, but across the whole of Europe. The experts say it's not confined to smoking, drinking and drug use either, but to things like teenage pregnancy and violence as well. So what's driving it? One explanation lies in new parenting styles, says Professor Frances Gardner, who's a psychologist at Oxford University.
It's across lots of countries and lots of surveys. They listen to their children more, they hit them less, but they're not just being softer with their kids. They also have raised expectations, they set limits more clearly, and they monitor their kids' whereabouts more closely.
But those who track teenage behaviour say the picture's more complicated than it seems. They worry that the teenage rebel's choice of alcohol, cigarettes and cannabis may be giving way these days to things like methadone or the gas nitrous oxide, drugs not picked up in this latest survey. As many as one in 20 young people in the UK have apparently inhaled nitrous oxide in the last year.
That's the BBC's Janet Berry. And there's one big kid who's in mourning this week. Arizona lost Bill Thompson on Wednesday. He's the man in the familiar derby hat and suit coat who entertained thousands of kids and adults each day on the Wallace and Ladmo show. For 36 years, it was a low-budget little TV program that created a lot of memories for loyal fans. KJZZ's Steve Shadley grew up watching the show.
Anyone who's lived in Arizona for a long time probably knows this song. It's the beloved theme of the Wallace and Ladmo show. When I was a kid growing up in Phoenix in the 1960s, I'd hear that music and run over to the TV and turn it up. That used to drive my little sister crazy, but she loved Wallace and Ladmo as much as I did. We grew up in a small trailer in the desert on the outskirts of town. We didn't have much. We didn't have air conditioning, only a swamp cooler, and we had a black and white TV. But we didn't care. We were all about the Wallace and Ladmo show. We loved the cartoons, the quirky little skits. And then there was that spoiled rich kid, Gerald, who was so stuck up, and everyone loved to hate the guy, dressed in his ruffles, that Dutch boy haircut, and old school eyeglasses. Despite their goofy costumes, they managed to stay in character. Wallace started the show at KPHO Channel 5 when Phoenix was still a small town back in 1954.
The station bought some cartoons, but none of the announcers wanted to do the kids' show because of the dignity of it, you know. And of course, I was begging, you know, so they let me try.
Glad to see you. Where have you been?
Welcome home. How've you been?
Hello there.
Welcome home.
Hello.
Ladmo. What are you doing?
I'm shaking hands with an octopus. Oh, hello there. Welcome home.
My sister and I would have given a pile of gold for one of those Ladmo bags full of treasures. I remember you had to mail a postcard to the TV station, and they'd draw names of winners who'd get to see the show and get a Ladmo bag. We would send our postcards every week, but they never selected our cards. Sometimes the skits would include some adult humor, and even my mom and dad would get belly laughs watching it. You know, I've heard some people complain that the show was too bold in its humor sometimes, but that didn't seem to bother Wallace.
Every once in a while, they'd write in terrible letters, and we'd read them. And then we'd invite them down to get a Ladmo bag, and they came. We still hate your show, thanks for the bag.
One day in the early 1970s, my dad took the family to see Wallace and Ladmo live at Christown Mall. They do events around town, and I was so excited waiting that day in the parking lot to see my favorite TV buddies. So excited, I almost wet myself. They pulled up in a big flatbed truck and used it as a stage. Wallace and Ladmo were there in real life. I couldn't believe it. They were dressed in purple and yellow, passing out T-shirts and yucking it up. When Gerald came on the stage that day, everyone in the crowd was booing him. It was so much fun. And to this day, I remember watching my dad booing along with all of the others. He might have been the loudest voice in the whole pack. One of my favorite characters that Wallace played was Mr. Grudgemeyer. He was an old guy in a straw hat with these really wild eyeglasses that had these weird fake eyes painted across the lenses. He'd sit on a park bench and throw breadcrumbs around on the ground, and he'd always say, "Feed the birds, feed the birds." Then Ladmo would walk up, chomping from a bag of chips, and he'd scare away the pigeons. It always ended the same way, with Mr. Grudgemeyer smacking Ladmo with his hat. That skit was on for years, and it sounds so dumb, but it got me every time. It was so funny. Mr. Grudgemeyer, feed the birds. Well, Ladmo died about 20 years ago, and now Wallace is gone. I heard he passed away this week while I was driving and listening to the radio. It got me a little teary-eyed, thinking about good old Wallace and those days gone by. My sister died a few years ago, and I know if she was here, she'd be as upset as I am. Bill Thompson, a.k.a. Wallace, was 82 years old, and to me, he's a part of TV history. I actually got his autograph on a Wallace and Ladmo promotional photo for a Christmas gift a few years ago. It's one of my prized possessions. Wallace, if you're listening, I just want you to know Arizona loved that show, and you made life fun. We'll miss you.
That was KJZZ's Steve Shadley, and thanks to KAET Channel 8 for the archive audio. It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Mike Swissler. I'm here at Rockler to take a woodworking class. Our woodworking class today is going to be making a cutting board.
Very good.
You're taking it from scrap, and you have to cut it and glue it together. I drove an hour to come to this. I love woodworking, it's a hobby, and the more classes I take, the better my skills can get. It's an awesome way just to learn and keep myself busy at home.
That's Mike Swissler taking a woodworking class at Rockler Woodworking and Hardware in Phoenix. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or want to take our orders for tables and chairs, send us a note, the show at kjzz.org. Quick check of Valley traffic. I-10 eastbound near Tonopah is closed eastbound. A semi-truck fire has caused that. ADOT says there's no timetable to reopen the highway. The interstate closed at milepost 89 near Tonopah. There's a blowing dust advisory in effect until 9 o'clock tonight. It'll be partly cloudy, slight chance of showers and storms for the rest of the afternoon with a high near 110. Partly cloudy, blowing dust, scattered thunderstorms possible tonight. Overnight lows right around 90. It's 106 degrees at KJZZ at 2:35.
KJZZ is supported by Roadside Attractions, presenting A Most Wanted Man, the new spy thriller based on the novel by John le Carré, starring Philip Seymour Hoffman, Rachel McAdams, Willem Dafoe, and Robin Wright, now in theaters.
Why do we choose to live in the part of the valley we do? A new project aims to get answers to that question. It's called Individualocracy, and it's the work of Matthew Selinger of CoLab Studio in Tempe and ASU professors Daniel Mayer and John Rasu. The finished product will be released next week in the form of 5 handmade books. 4 of them are pop-ups and 1 is a data book. Selinger and Mayer joined me this week to talk about their project, which started about 5 years ago.
Interestingly, once we started the research, we started to learn all kinds of things that we didn't set out to learn, but understanding more about why people make the decisions of where to live also came out in the research.
And Daniel, what kinds of factors did you look at as to determining why people chose to live in different parts of the valley?
Well, I think the sort of beginning from scratch in our initial collaboration and discussions was really sort of a wide open table as far as the information that we might gather, and this was a massive amount of data that Matt was looking at, we were looking at, and we really had to sift through this data. You know, Matt divided the city into zones, and we had inner zones, outer zones, middle zones. We found quite surprising sort of the different responses from different people.
And Matthew, I wanted to ask you about those zones. It looked like, based on the map, there are 3 basic zones, one sort of closer into the city, one a little bit further out of the city, and then the third is sort of the outskirts. Is that about right?
Yeah, the central zone we're calling the downtown cores area, and it's a loop that goes around the downtown cores of Phoenix, Tempe, Mesa, Scottsdale, and Glendale. And the zone outside of that is outside of Zone 1 and all the way up to the 101-202 loop. And then Zone 3 is anything outside of that, which we called the outskirts.
Daniel, was there anything that was surprising to you about what you found in the research?
I think basically with this project, the main focus is the individual and the individual who makes choices.
That's right. The thing that we were trying to research more than, or suggest more than anything else, is that everybody really controls the politics, economics, the culture of the city and its aesthetics all through the small individual choices that they make every day. And they're doing it collectively whether or not they realize it. And so part of this research was really meant to try and bring some of that out.
So, Matthew, why do people who live in sort of that central corridor choose to live there?
Well, interestingly, when we asked people to name the reasons why they lived where they did, 71% of people living in Zone 1 used the word location. There was some issue of location. 62% in Zone 3 on the outskirts also said location, but in the middle zone it was only 35%, so location wasn't that important. There were other issues, and mainly it was about certain proximities or a certain cost level. But what's really interesting is that the research also showed that people in Zone 2 are the most content of where they're living and also by far the most likely to move away. They want to move somewhere else. And so that strange set of data starts to tell us that these people that live in Zone 2, a lot of them are able to live anywhere. They're happy to live anywhere, and they're very transient. They want to move around, or they do move around.
Daniel, looking at some of the folks who live in the Zone 3, the more outskirts zone, were there particular reasons other than location that folks chose to live there?
Well, I think we simply think it's location, and maybe not the isolation, but simply getting away on the outskirts and enjoying the natural desert environment, I think was, you know, primarily, you know, some of the main reasons, but also part of the study also showed, and we know this, is that, you know, the developments prior to the sort of recession, depression, things were being built out further, quicker, and more inexpensive, so that sort of accelerated, you know, this notion of sprawl.
I hate to have to ask this question, but given the fact that you started your research 5 years ago and given sort of the transient nature of the Phoenix area, is this data outdated at this point?
I tend to think not, for a couple of reasons. Number one, we're really just recently coming out of the Great Recession. And so I think a lot of the same people were living in a lot of the same places. I think second, the data that we collected, for the most part, when you look at other data research from how people live in cities, it's very similar. For instance, the reasons why people chose to live downtown versus the outskirts are similar to other research. So we think that the data is still really solid. I do think it's really interesting to note that the way that people think about the city, when they're less connected to it, they're less involved, yet they're still controlling, like I said, the aesthetics, the economics, the politics, everything about it. And so we really need to understand how to keep people engaged in the city, in every single part of it.
Matthew Salinger, who along with Daniel Mayer and John Rasu is behind the project called Individualocracy. The five-book set will be released a week from tonight at the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art. Telling stories is something that, for a lot of us, comes pretty naturally. Did I ever tell you about the time my Uncle Jack? That sort of thing. But the art of storytelling can be used for a lot of things. Healing, cultural exchange, building community. A conference in the Valley this weekend is bringing together storytellers from around the world. KJZZ's Nick Blumberg went to find out what makes them tell.
Two of the storytellers I talked to had the seed of the idea planted early on with a little push later in life. For New Jersey-based teller Queen Noor,
I started writing poetry when I was 9 years old, and my father recorded me to jazz. The very first story poem I ever wrote was about Crispus Attucks.
Then, about 20 years ago, she went to her daughter's preschool to present Kwanzaa. Part of the celebration involves sharing your talents, so Noor read the class her late husband's favorite story. Later, the teachers asked her back to read it again.
But they lost my book. And I said, you know, I think I can do this.
Storyteller Liz Weir came to the conference from Northern Ireland.
I'm old enough to remember a time when there wasn't any TV, so I grew up listening to stories.
After leaving school, Weir became a children's librarian. She describes herself as shy, believe it or not, and was taken aback when she was told she'd have to read to groups of children. But when she started...
I saw the magic. You just captured them with a told story. And when I put the book down and told nothing between me and the child except the voice, that really hooked me. So I've been telling stories for about 40 years now. Long, long time.
Weir and Noor are both in town for the National Storytelling Network's annual conference. I asked them what it's like to be in front of a crowd telling a story.
It's an interaction. It's
it's intimate.
A wonderful storyteller, Ed Stuyvesant, talks about dancing with the audience, yes. And I think that's the thing.
There's that connection, right? So there's not that fourth wall, like in theater.
And that connection with the audience can be powerful and healing. Liz Weir said a friend's father died recently, so the man's family and friends gathered for a wake.
And this disreputable friend of his that they were all going, oh, he's in. And he was sitting with a pint of Guinness balanced on the coffin, you know, and they were all going, this Guinness. But he was saying, do you remember the time we did that? Isn't that right, John? So even though John was dead, he was still part of the story.
For several years, Queen Noor has told at a camp for children dealing with suicide in their families. After she told a story about the legendary Brother Blue's father,
they said there was a breakthrough for this one child who hadn't released at all. Her father had committed suicide, and she released after that story. The whole camp, you know, felt that.
It may sound counterintuitive, but Weir says part of being a good storyteller is listening. She encourages young people to ask their grandparents and older relatives about their lives.
If you want them to tell a story, the worst thing you can do is say, have you any stories? Because they'll immediately say no. But you say, tell me, what was the first money you earned? Or the house you lived in, what did you see when you looked out of it?
Engaging people and getting them to talk about their lives is what the Arizona Storytellers Project is all about. It's a series of live storytelling nights that happen about once a month. Its founder is Megan Finnerty, an Arizona Republic reporter. She first pitched the project 3 years ago.
And my bosses were basically like, great, don't stop doing your job and don't cost us any money, which is, you know, how bosses say yes to things all the time. It was really great because they really took a chance on me and they really took a chance on storytelling. And I think they took a chance on Arizonans because, you know, a lot of people think Arizona is a place without culture or a place without community.
Finnerty says Arizona Storytellers proves that's wrong. And she says the project serves an important role because a lot of other storytelling events only work with ringers, professional writers, comedians, or performers.
We work to teach and empower all kinds of people to tell their story in a way that is entertaining and authentic.
Finnerty says the events both reflect the community and engage it.
The big message that I've learned with this is that everybody has a story worth telling. And more importantly, everybody has a story worth listening to.
The National Storytelling Network Conference runs through Sunday in Mesa, and you'll be hearing some of the stories from the Arizona Storytellers Project events right here on KJZZ. Stay tuned for details. It's the show. I'm Nick Blumberg.
We head now to another of the valley's threatened places. Tempe's Maple Ash neighborhood is one of the city's oldest surviving neighborhoods, and historic preservation advocates say its character is in danger. The neighborhood basically runs from University to just south of 13th Street and from Farmer east to Mill Ave. Karen Gitlis has lived there since 1980 and started working on preservation efforts 6 years later. Sitting in her dining room, she describes her neighborhood.
The neighborhood is very old. It goes back to the first platting closest to the downtown area. Gage Addition was platted in 1909. The majority of the neighborhood is just to the south between 10th and 13th Street, and that was platted in 1924. The houses are small. My house is 1,200 square feet, cottage, bungalow types of houses. The neighborhood also gets flood irrigation, and that was something that evolved out of the farm lands and the irrigation canals that were supplying the water to the farms. But that has given this neighborhood its well-known characteristic, which is large trees, lots of green. We tend to be about 10 degrees cooler in the summer. And the house, the streetscape is very friendly. People are in front of their house all the time. They're working in their yards. They're sitting on their porches.
So what is it about this neighborhood that's threatened? Why does this make the list of most endangered historic places?
The neighborhood is threatened because it actually, although the characteristic of this neighborhood is single family homes, the neighborhood is zoned exclusively multifamily. Part of the endangerment is due to the fact that these properties have potential to be developed into money-making ventures, larger apartment complexes or condominiums.
With those new developments, are they replacing homes that are vacant? Are they replacing empty lots? What was there that is being replaced?
Some of these houses are being torn down really, we do have a few empty lots. But for the most part, what happens is, and what we've been able to work to our advantage, actually, with developers, is getting historic preservation on a project to help mitigate the massing of what they're building around that historic house.
Are the homes in this neighborhood generally owner-occupied? Do they tend to be rented? How does that work?
Yeah, that's another big problem. And rental housing is among the highest level in the city in this neighborhood and some of the surrounding North Tempe neighborhoods. So we're looking at figures between 50 to 60% rental. And although I don't have an exact figure, I would guess that it's a little bit over 50% rental.
How optimistic are you that ultimately this neighborhood will keep its character, keep the kinds of homes and green spaces and all, and that, you know, in 3, 5, 10, 15 years, it will look pretty much the way it does now?
I think that there's a kind of stalemate between historic preservation forces and the development forces. I'm hoping that we can lessen the impact of large projects by putting in place rules that would allow us to maintain a streetscape showing individual properties, even if it was a complex. We're not against development. You could build a complex that actually carried out the neighborhood motifs.
Karen Gitlis has lived in Tempe's Maple Ash neighborhood since 1980. It's on the Arizona Preservation Foundation's list of most endangered historic places. And now it's time for the quiz show. We're joined again by Leszek Pawlowicz, our resident quizmaster. Each time he's on, he'll play one of us in a game of trivia hosted by our producer Sarah Ventry. This week, he's playing me. A couple weeks ago, we gave you a word puzzle to solve and randomly selected one correct entry. The question was, what five-letter word becomes shorter when you add two letters to it? The answer, short. Our winner this week is Stephanie McDonald of Mesa. Leszek will play on her behalf. If he wins, Stephanie gets a special KJZZ item. If I win, well, we mentioned her name on the radio. So here goes.
Recently, a man from Virginia traveled to Africa and claimed a piece of uninhabited land. He also claims that this makes him the king of this land and gives his daughter the new title Princess Emily. What is the name Jeremiah Heaton gave to his new kingdom? Is it A, the Kingdom of North Sudan, B, the Kingdom of South Egypt, C, the People's Republic of Virginia, or D, Hetonia?
Boy, this is just going to be a complete guess, but Hetonia.
That is wrong, Leszek.
Yep.
The correct answer is North Sudan, the Kingdom of North Sudan. All right, Mark, the next question is for you. Which of these ironic stories is the real one from this week's news? A woman named Carrie Dean became the newest hire at Carleton College in Minnesota, taking over the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. This means that her new title is Dean. B, a memorial tree in LA's Griffith Park, planted in honor of George Harrison, recently died of a beetle infestation. C, President Obama stopped for a photo op at an animal shelter in Northeast D.C. While he was posing for a picture with some of the adoptable kittens, one ran out of its soft carrying case, prompting the president to say, "Well, I guess the cat's out of the bag." Or D, an old man named Leonard Oswald of Dixon, Iowa, literally turned 98. Then he won the state lottery and died the next day, and thereby lived out the lyrics to Alanis Morissette's Ironic. Which of these is the true story?
Wow. I really would like for it to be D, not because the gentleman passed away, but just for the story. I'm going to go with the Carleton College Dean.
Wrong.
It's B, isn't it?
It is B, Leszek. It is that the memorial tree for George Harrison died of a beetle infestation.
That was totally going to be my second guess.
All right, so it's nil-nil, anybody's game. Leszek, the next question is for you, and it's an audio clue, okay?
My reason for contacting you is because I was looking for a surgeon to help me in my quest to rebuild and modify my body. So I've come up with some new plans for quadricep implants, calf implants, and lat implants.
I've never seen anybody design their own plastic surgery like that.
So this is a clip from a new TV show on the E! Network where people have plastic surgery, often to correct the surgery that they've already had that somehow went wrong. What is the name of this show? Is it A, Silicone Stumble, B, Butchered, C, Operation Overhaul, or D, Botched?
You know, I don't think a lot of NPR people watch E! On a regular basis.
Hey, speak for yourself, Leszek. Some of us do.
Once again, complete guess, C, Operation Overhaul.
Oh, that's wrong. It is actually Botched.
Oh.
Sometimes watching reality TV pays, Leszek.
In some very limited cases.
Yes.
All right, Mark, the next question is for you, and it's also an audio clue.
No family. No food. No heat. 15 everyday people will dedicate a year of their lives to build a dream society.
It's a fresh start. It's like a restart button on life.
That sounds intense.
What? Okay, so this is part of the trailer for a forthcoming show on the Fox Network in which strangers get put together and tasked with creating an ideal society. What is the name of this show? Is it A, Paradise, B, Bliss, C, Utopia, or D, Real World Society Edition?
Wow. This is a pure guess.
Okay.
I'm going to say Utopia.
That is correct.
Woohoo!
It is Utopia.
Very good.
All right, so Leszek, this is do or die, okay?
Yes, it is.
All right, your question. Which NFL player rolled up to training camp this week in an Indy car?
I'm going to say Sam.
No, it was Reggie Wayne.
From the Indianapolis Colts.
Oh.
Mark, congratulations. You beat Quizmaster
nice
Leszek.
I am speechless. Literally speechless. Yet I'm still finding words to say right now. So sorry, Stephanie. We'll keep bringing Leszek back every so often, so stay tuned for the next listener puzzle.
This weekend, some Arizonans will be taking part in the German-American Folk Festival in Berlin. They include the Native American Indian fusion band Clandestine and hoop dancer Tony Duncan. For many years, the travel route has been reversed, as Arizona is an extremely popular tourist destination for German travelers. Dirk Seberg was born in Germany and is actively involved in the Valley's German Society of Arizona. He says his passion for the American West shares a lot in common with other Germans.
I picked up a copy of one of the adventure novels written by Carl May. He is, I would say, single-handedly responsible for his influence on German readers, especially young readers, and portraying the Old West as, an adventurous area, out in the New World.
Tell us when he was writing, and when the books are set as well.
They're set in the early 19th century, and he wrote the novels and the late 19th century. Most of the stuff is fiction, and I guess in the later years, he wrote some novels that were more grounded in reality. But it's interesting because sometimes reality and irreality kind of mixed together as he was writing them.
When you mention things like adventurousness, what are some things that come to mind for you?
Traveling through the Old West and exploring new areas, and meeting natives and negotiating with them, that kind of thing. Carl May had an inkling for the underdog, so to speak, and he was usually on the side of the natives, and that's how German readers were approaching the Old West, sort of with an eye toward the Native Americans.
And as someone who has lived in Arizona and lives here now, has it lived up to some of the things you thought about when you first read Carl May?
In some ways, yes. In some ways, no. I've lived here for a while, but, I was a city kid, and I'm a city dweller now. So, my my exposure to the Wild West, so to speak, hasn't been, you know, that great. But I would say that imposing features of the state that have made an impression on me, and they are somewhat reflected in the novels that I read as a child, yes.
Dirk Seeberg, who's actively involved in the German Society of Arizona.
It's become a symbol for a town and its college, and for more than 50 years, it's also been a landmark for one of the state's most famous sports rivalries. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez tells us more.
High above downtown Tempe and visible to planes flying to and from Sky Harbor Airport is Tempe Hayden Butte, better known as A Mountain. It's nicknamed after the big gold A that's nestled on the hillside. It's a symbol for Arizona State University. Did you know A Mountain has been the bedrock of the rivalry between ASU and U of A since the 1950s?
History has it that back in 1952, in the dark of night, some of the students from down at the University of Arizona came up and took some dynamite to that A and blew it off the mountain.
Dan Turbyfill is with ASU's Alumni Association, the group charged with preserving the A.
Once they found out that we had an A on our mountain, that might have sparked a little bit of outrage. Because the A hasn't always been an A up there.
Tempe Hayden Butte has had several letters on the mountain. In 1918, students of the Tempe Normal School installed the first letter, an N. It was changed to a T in 1925, when the school was renamed Tempe State Teachers College. And in 1938, a different letter was installed, an A, for its new name, Arizona State Teachers College. Each time, the letters were created with loose rock. The A sat on the mountain for 20 years before it was blown off. By 1955, ASU replaced the letter A once and for all.
It's made out of reinforced concrete, so it's got rebar in there, and then the concrete's poured over the rebar, and it stands 55 feet tall and 60 feet across.
The mountain has become one of the most recognizable and iconic land features in the area. Because of its historical significance, Tempe Hayden Butte, A Mountain, is listed as a preserve park. The foundation of Tempe's first water reservoir from the early 20th century is located near the top of the hill, and there are more than 500 Hohokam petroglyphs here. Turbyfill says caring for this hill is taken very seriously.
We actually have a student that lives over in student housing, actually. They keep an eye on the A, so when they wake up in the morning, they check the A, and if it's anything other than gold, a text message goes out and the A team mobilizes.
Sounds dramatic, but there is such a team. The crew routinely repaints the A with a color actually named ASU Gold every time it's needed. They also help maintain school traditions. Each first week of fall semester, hundreds of freshman students are seen marching up the Butte Trail to whitewash the A to signal the beginning of a new school year. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez.
Thank you so much for listening to the show this week. I'm Mark Brody. This is listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. It's 3 o'clock.